Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, folks. You're listening to The Hang, hosted by the Broadway Podcast Network. This week, I got to hang with a great actor, singer, writer, and friend, Nadeem Namah. Nadeem and I first worked together last year on Rumi the Musical, which is the show he co-created with Dana Al-Fardan that was inspired by the Middle Eastern poet Rumi. It was such a joy and privilege to work on that show, which really spoke to me and my heritage. And in this podcast, Nadeem and I discuss our experiences of being Middle Eastern in a Western world, some shared, some very different. We also talk about how our industry is changing for the better when it comes to accepting artists of different backgrounds. I really enjoy chatting to Nadeem, and I'm so inspired by him and the work he creates. Take a listen.
Speaking of names, though, I remember I was on a cruise ship once and I was doing a cabaret, and they're letting the compere was there. And here we have opening the show, we have Ramin. And you can see his brain's like, fuck, what's his last name? How do you even say it? Ramin. Ramin! And as I walked by, we were crossing like that. He's like, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I get that a lot. My surname is
Nadeem Namah.
Yeah, you know it.
Nadeem Namah, welcome to The Hang.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm so glad you're here.
It's cool to be here.
I've missed you.
I've missed you too.
That Rumi was quite the experience.
It's been like, it was what, about 6-7 weeks ago? But it feels like a long time. It feels like a lot's happened since then.
Yeah. And I feel like we did that was quite an intensive 10 days, 2 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah.
For me personally too, because I was just flying back from New York, I believe, or I was off to New York.
You had just got back.
We were juggling a lot.
And we were juggling a lot. And we picked it up, like we started working on the project about a year ago, I guess. But it was very sort of bitty. Like a few days here, a few months. And then the actual show, it was 2 weeks.
Yeah, because we obviously recorded the album as well.
We did, yeah.
Which was sorely overlooked at the Grammys.
Sorely overlooked. In favor of albums of things that have been recorded like many times, which I think is a bit of a shame.
Well,
but hey.
All I'll say, because I'll never... doesn't matter what else is in the category. Here's the timeline. You sent me the music. I remember you sent me the whole breakdown for Sham's character. This interview's about you, by the way, not me. But it's about your work. And I remember you said, we're going to do Rumi the Musical. And my ego, oh, Rumi, yeah, I'd love to play Rumi. Oh, no, you're Shams. I read the character. 50s, what the... And I remember right away, I'm like, Nadeem, what are you going to change the age? What's going on? Then you sent me the music, and I remember it was just piano tracks with your scratch vocal.
Yeah, like the original demos, yeah.
Instantly wrote you back, we're doing this. This is some of the most beautiful music. And then we recorded the album. Again, it wasn't a full orchestration, some MIDI stuff, just enough to get by. Mm-hmm. Then when you sent me the album, I can't believe the production on it. You have the producers, obviously we love them, they're amazing, Auburn Jam Music.
Yeah.
And I remember right away, I'm like, you got to put this in for a Grammy.
Mm.
It's stunning.
It was a very special project. And I think what we really had on our side all along was just the uniqueness of it.
Mm.
You know, the combination of West End / Broadway style in approach, but with a sound world and a subject matter that was very much of Persia and the Middle East. And on top of that, sort of cast of 16, giant orchestra, doing all of that in a lockdown as well. So recording across continents on Zoom. And yeah, it was just a one of a kind project, I think. And my favorite part of the whole experience was being able to approach performers such as yourself and offer an opportunity for you to do what you love doing, but tap into your past and your heritage and your family and your upbringing. And I feel like that's something I only discovered a few years ago, because you'll have had a similar experience when you start working in the West End. You're kind of anglicized, you're kind of trying to fit in with everybody else, and there aren't any opportunities for you to express your cultural heritage. And then, yeah, putting some Middle Eastern stories on their feet opens that door, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, there's some things in there that resonate, and there's some things that instantly I wanted to... When you talk about... Because with our careers, I never really thought about representation. And you know, we've had these discussions together privately, and I'm like, I'm not... I get this almost allergic reaction talking about representation, because I'm like, I've been Iranian all my life, and now people want to talk about it? Fuck off. Mm. You know, I feel like we represent by just showing up, working hard, being part of who we are is who we are, you know? So, like, I brought the Iranian to Phantom.
That's it.
That's what I was always trying to...
It's a really good
...try to do. And now,
you were already doing it.
My question, like, I remember in when I got to Rumi rehearsals, and it really gave me pause for thought, for sure, when a couple of the artists were like, Ramin, you broke the glass ceiling for us being an Iranian artist. And I was like, did I? Why? Why did you think there was a glass ceiling? Who told you can't do it? That's what I want to know. It's like, no one told me I couldn't do it. Yeah. And I'm growing up in Peterborough, Ontario, which real hick, small town, Iranian. You want to be what? The Phantom? Yeah, whatever, you know?
Yeah.
But no one said to me, I can't do it.
Yeah.
Now, I know everyone's got their own experiences, and that will dictate their response and their, you know, their first step.
Yeah.
So it did open my eyes to maybe there is something to it. Of course, that it makes people... You know, my name's not Chad or Brad, you know, it's Ramin Karimli, which is already going to be like, oh, that's different.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'm still struggling with the whole representation thing, and it's not something I find comfortable talking about. I'll listen because I'm trying to learn as well.
Yeah.
But it's odd to be in a position where you feel like people are taking listen for that reason rather than what we do, you know, what we dreamt of being
actors. Yeah, 100%. I know exactly what you're saying. And I think that, you know, it's unavoidable that, and this is something we've discussed as well previously, like trends occur. And I think that there are a lot of fights out there at the moment, a lot of causes that people are rallying behind. And one of them at the moment is this sense of people being proud of where they come from and wanting a level playing field for their heritage and their culture alongside all the others. So when you're in an industry where you have... movements, very powerful movements like Black Lives Matter, you're then awakening a sense of spirit and a voice within other communities who are then saying, well, yeah, this is amazing. And if the Black community can be this vocal about it and get support and allyship from other communities, what about our community? What about, where are the Middle Eastern stories? Where are the Asian stories? And I think that you're completely right to say that you were already bringing it. And I think that's what's so inspirational about you and what the younger cast members in Rumi were saying to you is, you know, seeing you doing it, seeing you play the Phantom with your name, with your heritage, meant that I knew that I didn't have to think about whether it was possible.
Right.
And I think that's what's really amazing about your trajectory. You sort of did it in reverse. You brought it, you represented, and you were a role model to a lot of people, myself included. You know, we're only a few years apart in age, but I remember coming to see Phantom when I was maybe 20, 21. And
I was 18 at the time.
Yeah. I love it. I watched you perform, and then I looked at the program in the interval and I saw your name. And the first thing was just like, oh my God, he's Middle Eastern. Nadim Ramin, my brother's called Kareem, your surname's Kareem Lou. It just felt like this is a dude whose career I need to follow. And then thankfully our paths have collided in this way that we can both tap into where we come from, and that's really cool. But essentially, yeah, I watched you take on this business and play these roles without there being anything to stand in your way based on your heritage. And that was very inspiring to me. And I think that why I started writing these shows was to just push that door open a little more for other people and just get people talking about our cultures in a way that's not associated with all the negative things that the Western media portray about the Middle East, be it the news, be it stories about terrorism or refugees, but also just in in cinema and TV. And you pick any American show about the Middle East, like Homeland, doesn't matter who's acting in it, doesn't matter how good the script is, I'll stop watching it when they try and pretend that they're filming a scene in Beirut on a Christian street where my family actually live, some of them. But then what you're watching on TV is like a desert with some goats and people dressed up like they're from Iraq or a different different part of the continent altogether. And they're just going, oh yeah, this is Beirut. And people just absorb that and people buy into that. And they don't have a real sense of what our part of the world is like and what it's contributed to culture and history. And
see, when you say stuff like that, and based on, you know, what I say is my allergic reaction to it because of my experience coming into Rumi and seeing all that and seeing what you created with Donna and how it resonated with me, that's what gave me pause for thought as well. Because I was like, well, this is where I felt like I was a student again, learning even about my own culture, but about how things are unraveling in the world today and our industry. So it's, and I'm more, less inclined to speak less about it because I'm like, oh, I've got more questions than thoughts. So that's why it was, I did feel I left enlightened more than I didn't even anticipate to explore that side and to know your story and what you just said, because that's not my experience. That's your experience. And that's why it's important. I was like, oh, wow, okay. It just made me really proud to be part of it and to see. I see what you're saying. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, and totally. And I love that you didn't have a, I love that your experience is totally different. I think that's really awesome. Can I ask you a question? Did you ever have any encouragement to sort of change your name for the stage or do anything like that?
No. I remember with Equity, I don't even know if I'm Equity member now or not, but you know, you have to choose one name.
Yeah.
And then you get a second choice.
Yeah.
I thought, no way in hell anyone's going to be called Ramin Karimloo. In fact, I think I am Ramin Karimloo the first. So I picked the craziest name for number two as a joke. I don't think I'll say it on air what it was, but I was like, one of my friends knows and he still calls me that. He's like, what if that what ended up being your name? I'm like, so?
Yeah.
However, who's going to have Ramin Karimloo?
Yeah.
So were you told to change
your name? Yeah, I had that experience in the first term at drama school. He was a really great teacher. He was a very nice man, but he was from a different era. You know, he was in his 70s at the time. So he's 90 plus now. And he was a great guy, but he was from the past, shall we say. And he said to me very early on, he said, you're going to have to change your name because your name doesn't match your colour. And you'll work more if people think you're British. And I was 21 and very naive. And I sort of sat there and was really impacted by this. And I thought about it for weeks and weeks and weeks. And I was like, what does he mean? My name doesn't match my colour. Like, he's obviously never been to Lebanon, doesn't know anything about the Middle East, if he thinks that all Middle Eastern people have brown skin, number one. And number two, surely the fact that I'm the only Nadim Naaman Lebanese guy in London is going to make me more unique and more of a talking point there. But he was, you know, throwing these suggestions, you know.
Yeah, I want to hear
the one I remember the most was Dean Norman.
Dean Norman. Welcome to The Hang.
Dean Norman.
From Lebanon.
And then I told my friends from university this story and they were like, oh, Dean Egg, you can't be Dean Norman. We want you to be Ned Newman.
Ned.
Yeah, so.
Welcome to The Hang.
You know, and I just like, it became a funny thing at the time and life moved on and I just threw myself into training. I made the decision not to change my name and I didn't really think
much more
about
it. Where did you get the moxie and the confidence to... No, you know what? I'm going to stay as Nadim.
I think just how much I love my Lebanese heritage and how much I love my Lebanese family and the idea of telling them that I changed my name to sort of pretend I was something else just made me feel physically sick. And I didn't really think much more about it for the few years after that. I just concentrated on enjoying my career and letting that kick off. But I think maybe 10 or so years later when these conversations became more commonplace again, I suddenly was like, I cannot believe that happened. And if it happened to me, how many other people has that happened to?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the polar opposite of what you would hope an educational establishment would teach, which is to just embrace who you are and be an individual. And how many times do we hear that as performers? You know, what makes you unique is what's likely to get you work.
100%, yeah.
And if we're all there changing our names and anglicizing ourselves and trying to convince people we're English or British, yeah, it just felt very, very uncomfortable. And that ignited a conversation in my head about wanting to embrace my heritage more and share it more with people and teach people about Lebanon, even if it's just about taking them for a Lebanese meal and seeing people go, oh, right, so hummus is Lebanese. I never knew that. I thought it was Greek or I thought it was Cypriot. And it's because in the supermarkets here, it will say like Mediterranean dish or
right.
They pick a country that most people have heard of. They all these little things, which are tiny individually, but over 20, 30 years, they add up. And you know, I combine that with my school experience here, with people commenting on my dad must be a terrorist, ha ha ha, you must be Muslim because of your name, why are you drinking? Muslims don't drink. Like all these assumptions, all these things you just have to absorb and take.
Wow, you got that?
Yeah, I got that a lot here. It's pretty bad and it adds up. So I wanted to rebel against it, you know.
Well, good for you, you should, you know. I can't remember if that ever happened to me. Friends, like growing up, I grew up with such a multicultural group of friends. Like we all said the most horrible things to each other with love.
With love.
And if you weren't in the circle where I grew up, you know, if someone says something to you, you give them a left and a right, fight's over, and then you have a beer afterwards or whatever you make up, but you don't say something stupid without getting a smack.
Yeah.
Times are different. I don't recommend doing that anymore. But that I found that inspiring with what you're saying and what you did, and I saw how you conducted yourself as an actor, as a producer, as a writer, composer in that room, as in Rumi, and it made me think I gotta do more with my life, but I loved how it was. I've always been a proud Iranian. Once I was told to change my YouTube channel because it's called Aromian Iranian.
Yeah.
And they were like, you'll get more followers if you change your name. And I said, I don't care about more followers. I'm going to be me and people either like what I do or they don't.
Yeah.
But I guess if you've, like yourself, you have more of a stoic disposition, but there will be people who might, maybe I should change it.
Yeah. And there definitely are.
Do you think that happens less and less nowadays, or it's still happening a lot?
I think it happens less, and I think it will happen a lot less now because I feel like, you know, we're talking about trends in the business. One of the current trends, I think, is for people to feel that by being non-white in any capacity, they have a voice and a platform that they didn't previously have. So I feel like people will embrace where they come from and who they are more and more, which is a fantastic thing. But I definitely have met some performers, even just doing auditions for Broken Wings and Rumi, older performers who have definitely changed their names to really British sounding things. And then you find out that they're actually like 100% Middle Eastern in heritage. Wow. But they felt a pressure 20, 30 years ago to sort of hide that for fear of being judged or pigeonholed or, you know, whatever it was to them. But it's fascinating.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
I'm conscious of time because there's so much I want to jump in with you. Because let's keep going with Rumi. Mm. Where did that come from? We've jumped in such into the deep end. I want to quickly rewind. Where did you train? Where do you start as the actor who wanted to be in a musical show to writing for, in my opinion, one of the best new musicals of our decade?
That's very kind of you to say. The whole thing started, so I went to university and I did a drama and English literature degree. And the main reason I did that was because I did not know at that point what department of this business I wanted to end up in.
Right.
So I knew I loved theatre, I knew I loved music, I knew I loved singing, but I didn't know if I wanted to be a writer, an actor, a director, whatever. So I just went to university and tried it all, which was a blast. And I did 3 years at Warwick University. And during the second year, I went to the Edinburgh Festival one summer and did a production of The Fix, the Dempsey and Rowe musical, The Fix, which was a total blast. And whilst I was in that, I met a couple of guys who were just up there on holiday, who had just finished this course at the Royal Academy of Music. It's a one-year postgrad course, musical theatre. And they said, you should totally check out this course. We think you'd be great for it. They love your type of performer. So I came back to university. I dug out all the information and I auditioned and I got in. So I finished university and went to do that course. And by the age of 21, had graduated and had my first agent and was lucky enough to land a role in The Sound of Music at the Palladium, which was a very cool first job. I spent a year understudying and then I got the part of Rolf. So I stayed for another 6 months. And I just learned everything about how a theatre works, how the departments interact, sound, lighting, stage management, covers, swings, all of that, like, which they don't teach you at drama school.
Right.
You don't get any exposure to any of that.
Pressing pause for one hot second. At this point, are you a musician? Like, are you a good musician?
At this point, I'm just like playing my keyboard in my flat and teaching myself guitar, but I'm not.
At what level I'm of a not, piano player are you at this point?
Not great.
Okay,
not great. The only writing I'm doing at that point is I'm spending my my holidays, university and drama school holidays, I'm writing theatre songs for a kids camp, a drama camp.
Oh, yeah.
Which was called Upstage, which is like my, my education in writing, I guess. It was, we used to write shows with kids over 5 days. So these kids would arrive on a Monday morning and by the Friday evening, there would be a 40-minute show with six songs and we would devise it all with the kids and stuff. And it was just, you got to write a song in 3 hours, go. So it was that kind of...
That's amazing. You get an audition now. Can you have this two tapes by tomorrow?
What?
Yeah. 24 hours? No.
Yeah. It's changed. Times have changed. But that was my experience of writing. And I think that maybe 4 or 5 years into my acting career, I was missing that creative side, that writing side. So I started writing songs for myself with no real intention of, at that point, of doing a musical, just songwriting and putting some recordings down and just making albums, but really enjoying that process. And then what happened was, 10 years later, I'm playing Raoul in Phantom, and I'm about to become a father for the first time.
That role does that to you.
Yeah.
Baby-making role.
Baby-making role. I am meeting Dana for the first time during that period. So she was in London doing a concert at Cadogan Hall of her own music. She was supporting another Middle Eastern artist.
And Dana's your co-composer. She's my co-composer,
yes. Broken Wings and Rumi. And she was opening for this Middle Eastern artist. And that was her first ever gig in the UK. And at the same time, that week, I did a small album launch of my own stuff at the Hippodrome in the casino.
In your own originals?
Yeah.
How did I know?
Which is called Sides. The album's called Sides. It came out 6 years ago. And
by Ned Norman.
Dean Norman. We met. We were thrown together by some mutual friends, one of whom was Ali, who was one of the producers on Rumi.
Yeah.
And we had this conversation where we both established that we wanted to write a musical. Neither of us wanted to do it alone because we had never done it before and we were a bit intimidated by the prospect. But we knew we wanted to write something that was of Middle Eastern heritage and something that felt very familiar to us, that we would be able to portray part of our culture easily. And so we made this decision over a coffee, basically, in an hour. We left that saying, okay, let's do this. Let's go away. Let's talk about it, think about it. And that kicked off this process that's been going on now for 5-6 years. And it's great fun. It's great fun.
That's not a long time to have two big musicals done. One about to come to the West End.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah. It's mad. It's mad that it's happened that way.
Usually it takes that time from idea to stage, maybe with a workshop, for one.
Yeah. I think we have a few things on our side. I think firstly, the decision on both occasions to record the album first. Just in terms of like...
But you had to have the story as well, so you know what you're writing.
Yes, yeah. Story, with Broken Wings, that was easier because the novel exists. And it's an adaptation of a novel. It's a very short novel. And it reads like a play. I mean, it's Gibran himself narrating it and it's split into very short scenes. So it felt just like it was crying out for an adaptation. And the subject matter and the characters in that story feel very familiar. So although the wider picture is the social context of Lebanon at the turn of the century, it's about arranged marriage, it's about... organized religion and the clashes between doing the right thing versus following tradition. Mm. But within that, you have a story that's inherently very kind of West Side Story or Moulin Rouge in feel, that kind of doomed lovers who desperately want to be together, but society and other forces are keeping them apart.
Right.
So that felt like quite an easy way into adapting something for the stage. And we recorded the album, and that meant that people could hear it, visualize it, and get behind the idea of supporting it. And I think the reason we were able to do both of these shows in the time period we've done them in is because no one else was writing shows about that topic or that part of the world. And then along comes the band's visit in the States, which is another example of how something came very quickly from off-Broadway to Broadway to Tony's, and then it's kind of gone again. It's kind of vanished into the ether.
Yeah.
And I think that there is a real hunger for stories from other parts of the world. And when someone presents one, you can find your way to the stage faster than, let's say, if you were writing a show about New York or London or Paris, because let's face it, there are a lot of shows about those places already and a lot more in the queue for development as we speak. So I my advice to any young writer who is thinking about what to do and where to put their creativity, I would say just to look for stories that haven't been told yet on stage.
That's a great advice.
And I think you will then find your way at the front of the queue a bit faster than, I don't know, writing a song cycle about 4 20-somethings in New York, because there are already 10 of those.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. At all. They're all brilliant in different ways, but that's been done. So I think if you do write a show like that, you're going to find it much harder to get it put on.
So then how are you and Donna juggling? Because Broken Wings is still a baby in itself. It's about to come back to the West End. New dates in early February. It begins.
That's right. Charing Cross 11th of Feb to the 26th of March, Charing Cross Theatre.
I miss him. I was so looking forward to seeing it.
I know. It's such
the plan is I'll be gone by then. But I was looking forward to seeing it this month, but I know it's been switched. But that's still an ongoing process.
Yeah.
How did you then decide, well, let's do another one in the meantime called Rumi?
I think that Broken Wings' journey was totally halted by COVID. At the time, we had just done a run at Dubai Opera House, which was amazing. And it went really well. And we were negotiating a run in Paris for later that year. And we actually, Ali and I actually had a meeting with the Paris team the day before the first lockdown was announced. We were sat on the South Bank in the sunshine, making plans about Paris, which is very exciting. And then the next day it was all just like the plug was pulled. And then a year passed and none of that stuff came back. The producers who were going to help us get the show there were like, we can't risk it. It's too much at stake. So we sort of put Broken Wings to bed, not forever, but we just thought, you know what? Like, let's just not worry about that now. If that show's going to have a life in the future, it will come back. And what happened was the Royal Academy of Music musical theatre course asked Brona, our director on Rumi, if she would direct a show there, a project for the students. And she came to me and said, can I do Broken Wings with them? And I said, yes, of course you can.
Because had she done the version?
She did the original Broken Wings as well,
the Haymarket.
That's right. And so we had this opportunity to dig the script out, make some tweaks, make some cuts.
Did you do rewrites?
We did some rewrites. Yeah, what we did was we reduced the cast size. So we sort of fused some of the roles together and made it so that there were fewer actors, but they all had a bit more to do.
Oh, very Cameron Macintosh of you.
COVID times, you know. And it was a great experience. It was really fun. Donna and I went to watch it and it was very moving. And it was great to see students doing this material. A very surreal experience for us to see that. And this sort of brought Broken Wings back to life. And what's happened now, of course, is that the wonderful Katie Lipson at Aria Entertainment has taken the show on as producer. So that's the short answer to your question. Katie is now producing Broken Wings and we are not. Whereas Rumi is still within our sort of hands.
Right.
And I think, if I'm being totally honest, if there had been no COVID, Rumi wouldn't be ready yet. So we would still just be doing Broken Wings and writing Rumi alongside. Right. But because we had this 2-year period where we had nothing else to really do, and Dana happened to be in London for 4 or 5 months at the beginning of, I think it was the second lockdown, she happened to be here and she just stuck it out. We were able to write Act Two in 4 months. Whereas Act One had already taken more like 18 months.
Wow.
So we were blessed with time because of a pandemic. And so now it's like we're in this weird situation where hopefully the pandemic's coming to an end and both shows are trying to kind of come back to life alongside one another.
How exciting is that for you?
It's very exciting.
Stressful?
Definitely stressful because of the uncertainty still.
Yeah.
So you know, it's this weird endless cycle of getting excited and then getting let down and then getting excited again and then trying not to get excited because you got burnt the last time.
That's why so anyone ever asks me, you excited, let's say, for Funny Girl? I'm like, I don't allow myself to get excited anymore.
Yeah.
I will be once I'm taking my first bow.
We're having to train ourselves to think that way, right?
Yeah, but it's hit me now, like, I'm exhausted from that underlying anxiety of constantly, because this is the father in me talking now, and I'm sure with you, you know, we still gotta support our families.
And,
with Rumi, then, is there, we put it on his feet, rewrites? What's your process on that at this point?
At the moment, with Rumi, I'm thinking more small tweaks than major rewrites.
Yeah, so I should ask, that sounded loaded. What's your takeaway after the Colosseum experience?
My takeaway is that the show really benefited from being written in an intense and short period because I have fewer thoughts for amending it than I did with Broken Wings, which was written over several years. And I think when you write a show over several years, you can kind of see parts of yourself in that script and in those lyrics of where you were at specific times. But Rumi feels like it's very channeled and very consistent within its world. And there is a definite flavor and sound and feel to the whole thing.
Yeah.
Which is very cool. And The main takeaway I have is that I'm really excited for the potential of this show because we proved that you can pack out a huge theatre during a pandemic when you do a show about something like Rumi. And if we can do that in London, where there are 30 other shows for people to choose from on a nightly basis, if you start taking this show to parts of the world where there may be a 4 or 5 other shows a night rather than 30, and there are people of Middle Eastern and Persian and Asian communities who adore Rumi, you have a chance to do something quite big, I think. So I think all we're going to try and do is consider the Colosseum version like level one and just keep layering it, expand that design, expand those costumes. I think there is definitely room for a few of the characters to have a little bit more exposure. I'm particularly interested in maybe adding a scene between your character and Rumi's wife, Kara. They don't have a moment alone together, which I think maybe was missing.
Right.
So I think like there'll be some tweaks, but the overall structure of the show and the order of the songs and all that I think flows very nicely. And I don't want to play around with it for the sake of it.
Do you think when you put on its feet again, because you never did a workshop for that?
We did a dance workshop and we did a script lab. But we never did a full workshop of the whole thing.
Do you think...
Because of COVID.
Do you think there would be a benefit to do that now, even though it's been on its feet?
Yeah, I think so. But I would think that maybe the way to do that would be to just have an extended rehearsal period next time out. So instead of just trying to revive what we did in a week, let's say, which we could do, maybe try and have like a 3 weeks or a 4 weeks proper rehearsal process. And to really just dive back in at the beginning, have the conversations, have the backdrop, the backstory, the context, and all that work that we had to rush to get the whole thing done in 2 weeks this time around.
I have to say, when that album dropped, the supporters that do follow me on this various social media things, that music touched, and I couldn't believe such a diverse group of folks that totally were moved by the music, the melodies, the story, the singing. And it's the first time I've ever been at a Zitzprobe where, one, I teared up. I've never done that before. And I found myself, what is this salty discharge from my eyes at a Zitzprobe? And I've never seen an orchestra so fully engaged in... I saw some of the string players crying at one point.
Yeah,
yeah. And I remember thinking, what is happening right here? It's incredible.
It has that... The subject matter and the world of Rumi, I think, has that power. And I think it taps in really, really well to the current state of the world. Rumi is about self-reflection, taking a step out of your routine and your habits and questioning familiarity. And just assessing what you really want out of your life and what you want going forward. And I think we all had that experience with COVID, right? We all had those hours on end locked away. What is my life? What do I want to change? What's making me happy? What's making me unhappy? I've certainly lived through a lot of that. And it's like I don't want to say self-help. It's not self-help, but it's definitely...
Self-reflection.
Reflection, analysis... Just connecting with yourself.
And being accountable for yourself.
And being accountable for yourself.
Which I think that is...
And that's the plot, really, of the show, isn't it?
It should be a plot of life.
It should be a plot of life. And it just goes, you know, they go. All these characters go on a journey ignited by your character, Shams, who encourages, essentially, his role in the story is to encourage change, encourage growth, encourage development, and we all need that in our lives because we get so weighed down by formula and routine and pattern that we very occasionally take a step back.
America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. By honoring your career calling, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
And I think one of the best analogies that we made in the rehearsal room was the similarities between books and literature and scripture in Rumi's world with the mobile phone and the laptop and the tablet today. And this thing that Shams says of, you know, put that down and look up and look around you. Everything you're seeking is already here. You just need to notice it and engage with it rather than living your life according to what someone else has written or someone else has created. And we do that.
Or these echo chambers we live in nowadays as well.
Yeah.
Well, I have to say, as you're talking about that, what really hit me was watching how you all stage Lightning, your one of your first main solos, which you do brilliantly.
Thank you.
You're one of my favorite singers. But
thank you.
Just that whole performance, that song, but seeing you taking their laptops and their tablets away. And as much as you've enlightened me as a performer, as a Middle Eastern man, it's made me think about things that I felt I was always doing, but I don't want to say taken for granted, because I always grew up thinking hard work, grit and hard work will get you where you need to go.
Yeah.
Just keep believing, keep eye on the prize. But it was great to kind of have that pause for thought, seeing with what you brought as a writer, as an actor, as a producer, as a friend in the room with all these Middle Eastern actors. It was really beautiful, and it made me, one, miss home. because
definitely, yeah.
All my roots are still back in Canada and obviously Iran. But now every time I take so much more pride when I see my Sunday message, your screen time has gone down 70%. I'm like, and it brings me back to that moment in the show, because I was like, yeah, we are. Why are heads here? Why aren't we looking up more?
Yeah, yeah. And people say it every day. Like, you know, you'll be walking around town with someone and they'll be like, oh, look at that building. It's so beautiful. I've never noticed it. I've walked past this road 300 times.
Yeah.
And we do. Like, we get out of the tube station, we walk to the stage door, we go into the theater, we get our coffee from the same place every day. We all live like that. And then we get home and we might check our phone or sit down and watch a TV show before we might just want to mix it up one evening and decide to do something with our kids in a different way or whatever it might be. I don't know. It's breaking the routine is everything, I think. That this way of thinking is encouraging us to improve our lives, or even if it's not about improving, just about exploring and reflecting. And I think that what was so beautiful is that the feedback from the audience tapped into this, and we had a lot of people saying, I just felt like I was somewhere else. I felt like you just took me away somewhere, as a company, as a show. I felt like I was somewhere different, and I was just moved, and I don't really know why I was moved, but I was. So I think that we're going in the right direction, and I cannot wait for us to pick this up again at some point, later in the year, all being well with COVID, etc. But to take this show to the cultures that the show comes from, I think could be quite a profound and uplifting experience for everybody.
Well, whether it's here, whether it's there, it's going to be, I think it's uplifting and beneficial for everyone, for the story, for this music, and how it touches their hearts without even them fully understanding why right now, but planting those seeds, I think will grow into something really beautiful. Buddy, there's a couple of things I want to ask you. Time is just slowly running out, so I figure, well, we might as well just keep it about Rumi and Broken Wings for now. But I want to just say thank you so much for, one, being here, but having me part of Rumi, the things you personally enlightened me about through our connection over the year, working on this project, seeing you work in this industry. I think we're in the midst of a very big force to be reckoned with in our industry with what you're about to become. I think you're going to be super influential in all the right reasons.
Oh, that's really kind of you to say.
I'm really proud to see the work you've done in such a short space of time. I'm super glad you're my buddy.
Yeah, I mean, listen, it's been
part of all this with you.
It's been a total pleasure for me to get to know you within the specifics of this experience, it's, you know, as I said at the start of this conversation, that I've been aware of you and your career since I was a student. And, you know, yeah, we crossed paths before. We did, I remember we did like Phantom 25th, the yeah. Albert Hall, and before that, Love Never Dies workshops, you know, before that was even a show.
Holy crap. Was that the act one or act two did you do with?
I did the full thing at Sherwood.
The third one
at Sherwood Space. And there was I like, yeah, I was, that was when I was in Sound of Music. So I was 21, 22, just doing my first workshop, learning.
You were 18. That's crazy.
And,
am I that much older than you?
You're not that much older than me. You're not that much older than me.
I was 28.
I think we're about 5 or 6 years.
Who's counting? Yeah. Who's counting?
It's nothing.
No one's counting.
So to kind of both just be existing within the business for all that time, but then to have a reason, a project that enabled us to click this way and spend this much time together and work together, like properly work together. Mm-hmm. And in a way that's deeper than just being colleagues cast in a show. Like, you know, there's a reason that we wanted you on this project, and it is because you are the perfect combination of leading man, but Persian. You're of the right, you're literally like, we couldn't find anyone on planet Earth more suited for this role and this show. And you could easily have played Rumi. We should maybe do that role switch thing that they do in some shows.
Yeah.
But is it Benedict Cumberbatch and Johnny Miller?
Yeah, let's do that one day. Swap every week.
Just for fun. But there's something about the dynamic between Shams and Rumi at this point in Rumi's life, where he's emerging, and we're always emerging and growing, but Shams is very much a man who is in his skin and wants to share and wants to help someone else grow. And I feel like we kind of have that dynamic in our friendship. And so it feels like a really natural, it felt so natural to do those scenes with you and those songs with you. And I regret already the day when you will be like shooting a Hollywood film and unable to do.
What are you talking about? I'm going to be shooting the one you wrote, so forget about it. Listen, I got a question from a fan on my app. I thought you could answer this one. I got three questions for you. One from the supporter on this app, and then two from me. Estera, I hope I'm saying that name correctly, would be really interested in hearing about the differences between playing a historical character and purely fictional one. Mm. How much creative liberty is there to make a character one's own, and how much is trying to accurately present who they were? Nadim springs to mind to ask this.
That's a really good question. In the context of the shows we're discussing today, I think that Rumi was difficult for two reasons. Firstly, he is a spiritual icon, and he is in many parts of the world he is a religious figure. In our musical, we're trying to explore him as a human being, but the reality is that he's an icon, and that makes it quite intimidating. Much like, I suppose, anyone who has played a role like Jesus Christ or Gandhi, or, you know, a famous, or Churchill, like a really famous, iconic person, you know that there are going to be people who have an opinion of this character. And if you don't match that vision they have in their head, you're just going to disappoint them. So that's quite scary. But what happens with Rumi in this instance is that we're exploring a part of his life before he became the poet, philosopher, icon. You know, if you see any paintings of Rumi or illustrations of Rumi, they are always of him at the end of his life, a huge silver beard, a man in his 60s, 70s. We're looking at how Rumi became that, and he's 35, 36 in our story. So that was quite liberating, because it was what we know about him at that point in his life is that he was a very well respected and revered, but very straight-laced teacher, the leader of the religious community in Konya, and his life was by the book. then through the events of our story, he shifts from that bookworm, scholar, to artist, poet, thinker type.
Yeah.
So that was the source for me of how to approach the character, was to not think about the fact that I was playing the finished article, but to yeah. kind of focus on the creation of that man, and rooting it in the relationships with his loved ones. Gibran in Broken Wings is easier because that was pretty recent. There's a lot of literature about him.
Mm-hmm.
There are video clips of him. There are photos of him. And he is writing in the first person in a lot of his books. And especially in Broken Wings, he's narrating it about yeah. his past. So he is telling you how he felt about things. So that feels like it's an easier template to follow.
Gotcha.
And the last bit of that question is that when I'm doing, obviously we will have our own processes, but when I'm doing a fictional character, our job is to kind of create that material for ourselves with the help of the director and the creative team and stuff. But yeah, to distinguish between doing your own research versus creating your own backdrop is the main difference. But even then, with fictional characters, there's often source material. So like even Phantom or Les Mis or any of these shows, you can go and read the book.
Yeah.
And the book will give you 1,000 ideas about how someone might walk, speak, what their hair might look like, what attitude they have, what temperament they have. And it's up to you how much you want to dip into that or just listen to your director.
Beautifully put, my friend. And very quickly, what made you smile yesterday?
What made me smile yesterday? Thinking about the fact that my daughter had her first ever swimming lesson on Sunday, and like just talking about that with her and reliving that experience.
Mate, that's made
putting your putting your child in the water and not being in the water with them for the first time. Yeah, if you, any parents out there, if you've not done that yet, when you do that, just prepare yourself for all the emotions.
And first childhood memory that comes to mind, if you don't mind.
First childhood memory that comes to mind. When I was about 5 years old, I was on a holiday in Spain, and my cousin was babysitting me, and she momentarily looked away and I fell in a fish pond. And I remember that getting out and being covered in like green algae and stuff. I know that's totally random, but
really
that is
thought
the youngest.
It'd be like the first time you had ice cream or something.
No, that's the youngest thing that I can remember, probably because I was traumatized.
From one swimming story to another.
Yes.
Brother, thank you so much for sharing. Thank you for coming on The Hang.
Thanks for having me.
Proud of you. You're awesome.
Love you too, man.
You've been listening to The Hang. I am Ramin Karimli. The Hang is produced by Mercy Productions and Desert Highway and recorded at Soho Live Studios. Check out my new app. Go to ramin.fan.direct, where you can find brand new content, giveaways, and exclusive news. Thanks for listening.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Suf's has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at SufsMusical.com.